is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mike Papantonio is on the line. By the way, happy Monday. Mike Papantonio is on the line with us. Hey, Pap, how you doing today?
Tom, how are you?
Great. America's lawyer and the ringleader of the Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com, of course, the website. So, Pap, I saw this piece over at foreffectivegovernment.org, and it's reprinted over at Truthout, on how all these companies are paying their CEOs more than they're paying in taxes. They're wildly profitable companies. What's going on?
Well, remarkable story. What you have is Congress is ready to prioritize tax breaks, and it's a lame duck session. And in this report, actually, there are several reports out there, but the one you're talking about, it shows this indicator of how large corporations are avoiding taxes completely. As a matter of fact, they're having you and me pay them money to avoid the taxes. It's startling, Tom. 30 largest corporations in America, the 30 largest, 7 paid their CEO more than they paid federal income tax last year. And out of all 7 of those firms, they're hugely profitable. I mean, big, big profits, reporting more than $74 billion collectively, and that's pre-tax profits. They received a combined total in refund. Now, understand, $74 billion that they brought in, and we give them a $1.9 billion refund from the IRS, and that's a negative tax rate of about almost 3%. But the point is, you and I and everybody watching the show paid for that. After they make their $74 billion, we give them that extra money, along, of course, with everything else, with subsidies. We give them police. We give them roads. We give them bridges. We give them military to protect their interests, and they don't pay any taxes. The 7 CEOs that led this tax dodging were paid $17 million apiece on average. Boeing, for example, Ford Motor Company, they paid their CEOs more than $23 million last year while they got tax refunds from the government, while they got government contracts, while they got government subsidies. They paid their CEOs $23 million. And by the way, the workers that were working for that company, the distinction was for every dollar a worker made, the CEO made $400 for every dollar that the worker made. And so this is a startling story, and we seem to just ignore it. You tell me where you're going to find this in corporate media today.
Well, you're not going to find you're not going to find this. And Louise and I over the weekend went to see the documentary about Ed Snowden. It's called Citizen 4, and in fact, Jeff Skoll was one of the producers. He also had made the movie about Julian Assange. I don't know if you've seen it. Have you seen it?
I haven't, no.
Okay. Let me recommend it. It's fascinating. But the carry home, one of the carry home messages that I got is that if you're a person with any kind of profile at all that's political, you can just kind of basically plan on every single one of your emails being read by some bureaucrat, all your phone calls being listened to, your phone periodically being turned on so that it's functioning as a microphone wherever you go, your computer, same deal. And, this is the new world. And in England, this is not only are they scooping up every GCHQ, everybody's stuff, but it's all perfectly legal in England. Here, you know, Keith Alexander and Clapper had to lie to Congress, and they point all this stuff out in the movie. And the other thing that they get into in the movie is how it's all privatized. And it really hit me that, you know, we have reached the point in this country where everything is being done for the big corporations and the billionaires. And anybody who dares speak out, this goes way beyond terrorism or 9/11, anybody who dares speak out, anybody who's an activist, whether it's an activist about factory farms or it's an activist against the war, they're going to be in a position where someday everything they do can be used against them. Have we made that transition from being a functioning democracy to a plutocracy?
Well, when I have to sit here and tell you, Tom, that your emails are being read and mine probably are too, yeah, probably we've made that pivot. And the truth is, one thing that you just said that I think is critically important, you'll miss it unless you listen carefully, and that is, these are private corporations that are doing this. And that ties into this story.
Right.
This story about tax breaks. Because some of those corporations that are participating in this, they're the ones getting the high tax breaks. They're the ones getting the government contracts. They're the ones getting every kind of sweetheart deal we could possibly explain. But it's not just those, by the way, it's not just those few corporations I talked about. Of America's highest paid CEOs in this country, 29 received more pay last year than their company paid in federal income taxes. And if you look at those companies, a lot of government contract companies, a lot of these companies are on the dole directly from the government. We're giving them tax breaks, huge tax breaks, as I pointed out, but we're also giving them all these other things along with these things that they expect, like good roads, police, military. They want to take, and unfortunately, there's nothing being given back. We are at a critical pivot in democracy right now, Tom. It's because we've become a corporation, and we no longer can see a distinction between corporate America and the U.S. government. They are one and the same. These CEOs that I'm talking about, the 29 CEOs, made $32 million on the average. And there again, for every $1 that the worker was making, they were making $400. Their corporations at the same time reported $24 billion in U.S. pre-tax profits. And so if you really follow the money on this, this is another gift. This is a gift for these private contractor companies that are involved in our military wars. They're involved in NSA scams of every kind. They're getting payoffs in a lot of different ways, and this is one of the ways we pay them off. Oh, look, the company that received the largest tax refund was Citicorp. It owes its existence to taxpayer bailouts. Citicorp, who has been, you know, they are like the thug of all thugs where it comes to Wall Street thuggery. They paid their CEO $18 million while pocketing an IRS refund for $260 million. Now, this is a company that we saved from their damned incompetence. We saved them because they were such disgusting, greedy hogs at the trough, and we have to come in and save them, and now we pay their CEO $18 million there at Citicorp. They pocket a refund from us for $260 million at the same time. And so rather than more tax breaks, you know, Congress has got to focus on addressing these deep flaws. But you can bet we're not going to see it. We're going to see more corporate subsidies, more closed loopholes. We're going to encourage excessive executive compensation. We're doing nothing to solve that problem.
Yeah.
Why? Because they're sweetheart deals for the very companies that you just talked about.
Because they're buying Congress. I mean, during the Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson and Nixon administrations, corporations were paying about a third of the total cost of government. Now it's about 8%. They've succeeded in buying enough politicians that they can drill all these holes in the tax code.
Yeah, and it's not, let me just tell you, it's as many Democrats as it is Republican. If you think there's any difference nowadays, good luck with that argument, because it's less and less of a difference. You know, what they've done is they have so much money, Tom, that they figured out they can buy both sides. It used to be they only had a limited amount of money that they could push around because it was before Citizens United. Now they're making more money than they can spend. They've got $4 trillion in their bank vaults that they're doing nothing with. So what they say is, now we have the advantage of buying both sides to where you really can't tell a difference between one or the other. That's why we had an attorney general who didn't prosecute anybody.
Yeah.
That's why you have this new attorney general that's being talked about, and she won't prosecute anybody either. So this is a great time in America for corrupt corporations. This is their
day. It sounds like a great time for citizen activism, too.
It is. Let's hope we can get some out there.
This,
huh?
There you go.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer and host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com. Thanks, Pap.
Thank you.
And welcome back. Pap, you still with us?
I am. How are you, Tom?
I am great.
I
hope you and your family have a wonderful Thanksgiving. It's the holiday weekend here. And so
back at you, Tom.
If there's anything, by the way, that you want to go off on, feel free. I'm curious what's coming up on Ring of Fire Television. I'm guessing you're doing a show on Sunday. You're on Free Speech TV.
Yeah, we are. Well, it's Farron Cousins and Scott and Damien, they've all put together a best of show. So they've got David Haynes is going to tell us how corporate greed and negligence have made our roadways at this an extremely hazardous place, from faulty ignition switches, dysfunctional airbags. Your vehicle is really, if you follow the stories that are out there, it's almost like it's a ticking time bomb. We've got Timothy Carr. He's a senior director of strategy for Free Press. He's going to give us the latest on ongoing battle that's taking place with net neutrality that Ted Cruz is. The politicians behind this have gotten paid about $8 million that we know of to defeat net neutrality. Howard Nations, and he's going to explain the growing gap between the haves and the have-nots in this country, and how we used to be just a talking point. We used to say, gee, what if it gets here that there's such a huge disparity? Well, now it is really here. Virtually every the 10 major reports that have come out that show there's zero questions that we have lost control of the gap between the haves and the have-nots, and now it's starting to affect the economy in a really ongoing kind of way, to where it's at the point now to where there's been an economic shift of investment away from the United States into Asia.
Right.
Attorney David Hirsch is going to tell us how the TPP, talking about Asia, could get fast-tracked from the new GOP Congress. They're dying to do it. They've been waiting to do it. And frankly, Obama has been dying to have this done. Peter Mouget, he's an attorney, specialist in securities. He's going to talk about the Securities and Exchange Commission and how they're delaying rules and regulations that would help end Wall Street crime. Unfortunately, that's not something that this administration or even Hillary Clinton is going to pay much attention to. That Wall Street crime actually ends up paying them big dividends by way of political cash.
And TPP, or as I like to call it, SHAFTA, the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement. This, even though it excludes China, we've already got a bilateral treaty with China.
Right.
This basically, we were talking in the last segment about how America and our corporations have merged, which was Mussolini's definition of fascism. This actually puts the corporations of these Asian countries above our own Congress in terms of the ability to make law and rules.
Yeah, we could have, for example, you may have anti-fracking laws in your state because the fracking poison is poisoning your children, it's poisoning the aquifer, it's causing earthquakes, it's destroying rivers and streams, it's putting a pressure on your water supply for your state. So your state may say, gee whiz, we want a law that says you can't do that. And then we can have one of the organizations that are a member of TPP come and say, well, we're sorry, you've lost your sovereign right to make a decision like that. We're going to sue you if you make us stop fracking. We're going to sue you, as a matter of fact, if you tell us that we can't hunt for whales off of your coast. If we can't kill dolphins off of your coast, we're going to sue you. So that's how bad this is. And Obama's been doing it secretly. If you were to line up 10 people and ask them what the hell the TPP is, they wouldn't know. It would be like that. I don't know if you followed the story where a reporter went to the Texas college campus and asked them who won the Civil War. Nobody could answer the question about who the hell won the Civil War. Yeah.
Amazing.
Incredible story.
Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com, and Ring of Fire TV here on Free Speech TV. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Medea Benjamin on the line with us, the co-founder of both Global Exchange and Code Pink. And Medea, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. The big breaking news right now, one of several, but I think this is of some consequence, is that Chuck Hagel is being pushed out as Secretary of Defense. Chuck Hagel was a combat vet from Vietnam, one of the few left in American politics, and it seemed to me that he was hired to kind of wind things down, at least visibly. I don't know, but is this, in your opinion, you have some great sources on this stuff. Is Obama doing an LBJ here?
Well, it certainly seems like the initial idea of Hagel coming in to get the troops out of Afghanistan, oversee the reduction of the Pentagon budget thanks to sequestration, all of that's out the window. And now we're back in full force in Afghanistan, back into Iraq, now into Syria. And Hegel is part of the disarray of this policy. If you look at the policy, Tom, there's no end game for Iraq and Syria that makes any sense. And you can just imagine the kind of disagreements internally about where to go on this. And I think to some extent, Hegel wanted to get out because he realized that this is just a losing battle.
Yeah. Yeah. For those of us who remember Vietnam, this is not just deja vu. This is deja vu with PTSD. And I'm wondering if Hegel is in that camp. I would love to be a fly on the wall. I don't know if you saw the piece that's at the top of Common Dreams right now. It's floating around the internet about how inside Syria, because of our airstrikes, because we've hit so many civilians, quote, by accident in the process of going after ISIS, that people are starting to flip to supporting ISIS and wanting to join ISIS. Where does our policy go and where should we be going? It seems to me like this is the law of unintended consequences. This is Vietnam all over again.
Well, it's even more complicated because you have all the ethnic divisions and you have several different countries and you have the Kurds thrown into the mix. And it is such a complicated soup that anything that the U.S. does then disturbs other pieces of it. And we've seen that already just in the last 6 months of U.S. intervening, how it's caused all these unintended consequences. So to think that there is going to be some option other than political solutions is really insane. And I would love to not just be a fly on the wall, but have a chance to have a drink with Chuck Hagel to see what he thinks, because I've seen him in these congressional hearings just twisting and turning when he's been asked questions about where does this strategy lead to, because he doesn't have the slightest idea. And I think as a kind of rational guy, he knows that this all doesn't make sense. I've even seen him when they asked him, in fact, Hank Johnson, the congressman, said to him to get some kind of a solution to the problem of ISIS, don't we need to be working with Iran because Iran plays such an important role in the region? And you know Chuck Hagel wanted to say, of course, and instead he had to say, no, we cannot cooperate with Iran. So this is a losing strategy, and Hagel personally, I think, is better off for having jumped ship right now before it gets even worse.
Yeah, yeah. It's remarkable. If we look at history, you know, you go back to the Truman administration, he basically allowed democracy to happen in both Iraq and Iran. And then Eisenhower came along, and Nixon was pretty much running his foreign policy, the vice president. And in both cases, we overthrew democratically elected governments and installed strongmen, the Shah of Iran and Saddam Hussein, or helped install them. I'm guessing that those are the two options that are in front of the DOD or in front of President Obama, and the democracy one, they tried both in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now, I mean, you know, the story, I think it was in this morning's New York Times, that the Iraq army is so corrupted, it's so hollowed out by corruption that it's totally useless and unreliable. Democracy is not working. Is it time to go find a Saddam Hussein and a Shah of Iran and install them? I mean, I don't think so, obviously, but I'm wondering if that's the thinking that's going on in the White House.
Well, whatever the thinking going on in the White House is not leading us into any rational policy. And I see that Jack Reed has said that he doesn't want this position. I can't imagine who would want this position at this point, because the White House has already made a commitment. And unfortunately, the Republicans are pushing for more intervention, and are ready to say that no matter what goes wrong, it's because the president hasn't done enough. And then from the left, there's almost no voice out there. We see now even Rand Paul wanting to make a declaration of war. Even Elizabeth Warren is not very good on this issue. In fact, says almost nothing about it.
What
so
should the left
no
be saying, Mattia?
From the left.
What should the left? What should we be saying?
we should be saying, stop the military intervention and let's look at the political solutions. Let's go back in the case of Syria, seriously, to get back to the Geneva talks and find a truce between Assad and the rebels so that they can jointly go against ISIS. Let's get further commitments from Turkey about sealing that border to stop the recruits from going in there. Let's get a commitment from Saudi Arabia to stop the funding of extremist groups. And let's give time and effort and working with all of the countries, including Iran and Russia, about how we can help the Iraqi government become one that is not representing the Shia, but is representing the Sunni community as well, so they don't flock to ISIS.
Yeah.
That's just a taste, but there's more political solutions and more political possibilities than there are military ones.
You are absolutely so spot on. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Global Exchange and Code Pink, codepink.org. Thank you, Medea.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And I should add, Medea is also the author of the book Drone Warfare. Check it out. We'll be back 28 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Interesting times we live in. We'll see. I am very concerned that President Obama could be squandering his legacy. What little the Republicans have allowed him to have, but really it wasn't. What little he was able during those 72 legislative days between the time Al Franken was sworn in and he got a filibuster-proof Senate, and the time that Scott Brown was sworn in 72 legislative days later and he lost his filibuster-proof Senate. In those 72 days, President Obama accomplished a hell of a lot, right? And the Democrats are the largest middle-class tax cut in history. They saved Chrysler and General Motors. They stopped the hemorrhaging of 800,000 monthly jobs. They increased education spending. They cut student loan costs. They strengthened hate crimes. They passed the Affordable Care Act, which was a huge. They expanded the Children's Health Insurance Plan. They expanded enforcement of child labor laws. There was Wall Street reform, Dodd-Frank. Credit card reform, it was part of that. Predatory lending to soldiers was restricted. The troops started getting paid for stop-loss time, where Bush had been basically just robbing them. He stopped torture. He increased spending on the VA. Equal pay for women, nuclear arms reduction. BP agreed to a $20 billion cleanup fund. The EPA was strengthened, which now the Koch brothers are, you know, and all the other right wingers are really working hard to undo. The FDA's powers were broadened. The 9/11 responders, they were dying like flies. They finally got funding for that. I mean, all this stuff happened in those 72 days. That legacy, much like Lyndon Johnson's legacy of what he accomplished with the Great Society, is about to be blown up by foreign policy blunders. And I get it. I mean, Obama's got to be feeling like, you know, he's damned if he does and he's damned if he doesn't. But you look at these reports, like, you know, for example, this piece about how. I got too much paper here in front of me. This piece about how the public in Syria, here it is, Dispatch from Syria, is written by John Qualey of Common Dreams. Months after the U.S. initiated military airstrikes in Syria with the stated goal of uprooting the Islamic State, new in-depth reporting from the ground in that country reveals that numerous forces once opposed to the group are now citing the U.S.-led bombing campaign as the reason to change their allegiances and join the very fighters they once opposed. Really? Well, of course, really. Just like, you know, we thought that the people in Iraq would just love us and won't this be wonderful, and everybody, not everybody partied, but 25 people partied in that little square where they tore down the statue enough to make it look like everybody was partying in the first weeks after the invasion of Iraq. But now, well, not even now, after a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, you know, it was obvious that we were occupying their country. They reacted to it much the same way we reacted to the British occupation of North America. back in the 1770s. To hell with this. I mean, we had snipers. So did they. It's not, you can't win militarily when you are, when your game plan, I mean, you know, we did win. We did evict the governments of Afghanistan and Iraq. We kicked out the Taliban, took us 3 weeks. We kicked out Saddam Hussein, took us a week and a half. And another month or so to find him and kill him. But then what? What do you do then? And this was the, this is the point that Dick Cheney made back 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when he said it would be crazy to go all the way to Baghdad. I mean, pieces would be flying in 16 different directions. Do you really want this? But these were these horrible mistakes that George W. Bush made. You got Dick Cheney? There's Dick Cheney back when he was in the Reagan administration speaking, or in the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, speaking truth about Iraq.
Once you got to Iraq and took it over and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? That's a very volatile part of the world, and if you take down the central government in Iraq, you can easily end up seeing pieces of Iraq fly off. Part of it the Syrians would like to have to the west, part of eastern Iraq the Iranians would like to claim, fought over for 8 years. In the north, you've got the Kurds, and if the Kurds spin loose and join with the Kurds in Turkey, then you threaten the territorial integrity of Turkey. It's a quagmire if you go that far and try to take over Iraq.
So, I mean, there you go. It's like, here we are. Brought to you by the guy who you just heard from and his buddy George W. And so then Obama comes into office and inherits this mess, and he's got this debate going on in the administration about, do we just basically bail out and do everything we can with countries in the region, negotiate stuff, do it diplomatically the way that Medea Benjamin was brilliantly arguing we should, or do we drop more bombs? Well, there's a hell of a lot of money to be made dropping more bombs. And you got a lot of politicians who are taking a lot of money from those companies that make the bombs and make the planes and make the drones and make the, you know, fill in the blanks. And then you've got the media, the news media. They're not interested in what the truth is or what the best policy is. They're interested in what's bloodiest, what's goriest, what's most interesting, because they're all driven by profits these days. And we end up with just a god-awful mess. There's no other way to describe it than it's a god-awful mess. It's amazing. There's a bunch of other stuff that I want to get into as we go through the day. By the way, I just caught this over a Talking Points memo. Steve Halber writing. Excuse me, Sahil Kapoor writing. Steve Halber did the AP photo. That Philip Puckett was this Democrat. He was the swing vote in the Virginia legislature. Terry McAuliffe, you'll recall, just won the governor's seat. He has not yet been inaugurated. And when the legislature was considering expanding Obamacare, expanding Medicaid in Virginia so that people, working people who fall into the red state donut hole, they're making enough money, it might be only $5,000 or $10,000 a year, but they're making enough money that they don't qualify for the state Medicaid for you know, deeply poor people, for the disabled, for the totally unemployed. They don't make enough money for that, and they make... Excuse me, they make too much money for that, and they don't make enough money to qualify for subsidies under Obamacare, because Obamacare was written in such a way that assumed that every state would take Medicaid. Of course, John Roberts in the Supreme Court blew a hole in that. So this guy, Philip Puckett, at the urging of Republicans, they offered him a job with the Republican-led State Tobacco Commission, big bucks, and they were going to give a judgeship, a cell phone, and a car to his daughter. This guy leaves office, and thus the Republicans take over the Virginia legislature, and they kill the expansion of Medicaid to the working poor. And, you know, I've talked to Terry McAuliffe a lot of times. I don't know him, you know, but, I mean, he's been on this program probably 20 times in the last 8 years, 10 years. And, you know, there's part of him that's kind of huckster salesman, and there's part of him that's politician, and there's part of him that that has some understanding and some integrity. And I, that third part, I think, came out. He left a voicemail on this guy's answering machine after the guy took the Republican deal. And the voicemail says, "Hey, Phil, Terry McAuliffe, I wanted you to know we just lost the vote, 20-19 in the Senate. Medicaid is done. I hope you sleep easy tonight, buddy." Philip McAuliffe, Philip Puckett, excuse me, Philip Puckett, just like Rick Scott in Florida, just like Bobby Jindal, just like Rick Perry down in Texas, he has blood on his hands. He's got the blood on his hands of the people who are going to die in Virginia because the Republicans refused to expand Medicaid. In fact, if you go over and take it a step further, go over to the Daily Beast and thedailybeast.com. They just published a piece titled by Malcolm McDougall, who is now dead, titled "How the Healthcare Bureaucracy Killed Me." And the subtitle summarizes the whole thing. Malcolm McDougall, a prominent speechwriter and creative director, was diagnosed with prostate cancer earlier this year. Even after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, his insurance company delayed and denied cancer treatments, despite McDougall paying his premiums. Here's what he wrote. He said, "How far will," and this guy writing this as he's dying, he's dead now, "how far will a health insurance company go to deny coverage when you're really sick? How willing are they to risk their customers' health and possibly their lives? Let me tell you my experience with Health Republic and its affiliate, MagnaCare." And then he goes on to say, he says, "For 5 months, ever since I was diagnosed with stage 4 metastasized prostate cancer, they refused to pay my medical bills. On October 20th, a nurse with Health Republic overruled my oncologist and my primary care physician and declared that a critical test to determine the progress of my cancer was unnecessary." Health Republic and MagnaCare. This is why, you know, these companies, these so-called health insurance companies, they're really banksters. That's what they are. They're money men. No health insurance ever gave a kid a vaccine, never diagnosed a disease, never treated anything. They handle the money. They're banksters. And they have that same pathological personality disorder that banksters have. Money at all costs.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is why there should have been a public option, and it's not too late to make the option being, "Hey, I'd like to buy Medicare rather than one of these for-profit companies."
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 15 minutes before the hour. Glenn in Layton, Utah, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Glenn, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I was wondering about the voter election count, whether or not it was counted correctly. And I was thinking that how could anyone believe that these states that voted for the various liberal ideas, gay marriage, marijuana, so on, could turn around and vote for the person who was against it. And I think the most important thing for the Democrats to do in the next 2 years is to go state by state and get some sort of change so that we can assure ourselves that the voter election count is accurate. What do you say, sir?
I think that's a very important thing. I did a half hour on it on television on Friday. It will be up. The second half of it just went up 47 minutes ago. The other part of it will be up in a few minutes over at youtube.com/thebigpictureRT. I'm going to repost those over at Conversations with Great Minds when I get off the air today, this afternoon. Yeah, I think that we've got a serious problem with our voting system, from the way votes are counted to the way people register to vote to the way Republican secretaries of state can push people off voting rolls, which clearly they did in this last election in ways that, at least in several cases, decided the outcome of the elections, in my opinion, and the opinion of my guests, Greg Palast and Brad Friedman. That said, there's a really interesting post right now, and I'm pretty sure it's over at Crooks and Liars,
where they play this clip of, or share this clip of Bill Maher going off on how stupid the American voters are. And, you know, how the American voters are voting against their best interest and all these kind of things. And then they looked at some research on public opinions about Obamacare. And what they found was that when people, when they just asked people, do you like Obamacare or not, 32% of people said, I like it. When they educated those people as to what was in the law, what is in Obamacare, 70% of people liked it. So it's not just a problem with our elections. It's also a problem with the fact that we have not a stupid electorate, but an uninformed electorate, because our media is not doing the job that media traditionally did. Our media is instead committed to making profits. And that should not be the first job of media. That's not why the founders wrote the press into the First Amendment, so that they could make more money. They wrote the press into the First Amendment so that they could hold government accountable. Am I making sense here?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, Glenn, I think this is the real, I mean, these are two very, thank you for the call. These are two very important issues. We need to have election integrity. We need to know that our votes are actually counted. We need to get rid of these touchscreen voting machines that have no paper trail, that are unaccountable. We need to get rid of all of the machines that are owned by private corporations, run by private corporations with closed source proprietary software. They all need to be disposed of. We should do like Ireland and sell them as scrap metal. But on top of that, we need to educate the American people. That's why I'm here 3 hours a day, 5 days a week in this radio studio, and an hour a day, 5 days a week in a TV studio, because we need to educate the American people. You can play a role in that too. Tag, you're it. We'll be right back. Ten minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Well, I've gone through a few of my rants today. I've got an amazing story I got to tell you about that's out of Science Magazine. I'm a AAAS member and therefore get the magazine, and about how skin color affects the probability of both a whole series of very serious diseases and birth defects. And I want to get into that in some detail, because it's just a mind-blowing study. And we will get into that either in the next hour or the third hour today. But now I'll pick up some of your phone calls here. Randy in Portland, Oregon, listening on X-Ray FM. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Well, hey, Tom Hartman. It's been a long time. It's good to have you back on the air in Portland.
Thank you, Randy.
Well, I wanted to talk about the drive for profits, and I think that the fact that corporations are legally bound to maximize profits is one of the problems, because we're being told by Russia, you know, if the Ukraine joins NATO, that's it. Let's go to war. I mean, that's a big one nobody will profit from into the future anyway. So maybe it's time that we listen to, you know, folks like the Pope who are saying greed will destroy the world. The shareholders have some responsibility to step back and realize that the drive for profits is a drive for war.
Mm. Yeah. What's the beep? Are you being recorded?
Somebody's trying to call me.
Sorry. Oh, that's your call waiting. Okay.
Yeah. So what can we do in our activism to slow down the drive for maximization of profits, since corporations are the main employers now? And I'm on one end, I'm supposed to think about the returns of a 401k, but on the other, the spiritual terrorism of possible nuclear war, because we all have limited resources we're fighting for.
Yeah.
You know, how do we strike that balance?
I think the original sin, the cancer at the core, you know, when cancer metastasizes, it shows up all over the body, but it always started in one place. And the original sin at the core of our transition from a functioning democracy to a functioning plutocracy or oligarchy is the Supreme Court's decision in 1976, I think it was, in Buckley versus Vallejo, that money is the same thing as speech. The spending money on political advertising is the same thing as speech, and therefore protected by the Constitution when it's spent by an individual for themselves. And then the expansion of that in First National Bank of Bellotti, then the following year in 77, that corporations can do that, and then the triple doubling down on that in both Citizens United and McCutcheon,
suggesting that therefore there are no limits on what, you know, billionaires and corporations and corporate fronts. So now we have the best democracy money can buy. It's no longer even a democracy. It's an oligarchy. And that's why MoveToAmend.org's work is so critical, because if we're going to turn this country back into a functioning republic, we have to undo the damage that the Supreme Court has done. Randy, great to hear from you. Are you the Randy who used to work with us over at Clear Channel?
Oh, yeah, that's me. It's
cool.
Good to have you back. And, you know, it's just all the efforts that we made together back in the progressive days. Like, my band went on tour to stop the whole black box voting.
Yeah.
Looking to get the paper trail instilled before the 2004 election, before we lost. So, I mean, the battle goes on. We're all in the war. We're all still activated. But I think you're right. MoveToAmend.org is something people can rally around who can't do anything about the NATO and the Ukraine, but we can make change at the root. And, I would agree with that.
I absolutely believe that everybody needs to get inside the Democratic Party and flip it, take it over, turn it progressive. And there's some good movement in that direction, the Elizabeth Warren, Jeff Merkley kind of movement. But that said, it's never political parties that change the world. It's always political movements. And we need to be involved in movement politics. Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, MoveToAmend.org, DemocracyForAmerica.com. MoveOn.org. I mean, there's, pick the one that you like, but get involved with grassroots, on the ground politics. Randy, thank you for the call. Linda in Plymouth, Minnesota. Hey, Linda, thanks for listening to KTNF.
Yes, good afternoon, Tom. I was just listening to your previous guests that you had. One of them,
Medea Benjamin.
Yes. And she was saying things that really irked me and always irked me when I hear these things from so-called liberals. Well, they don't call themselves liberal. They call themselves progressive, which also upsets me as well, too. And what was she saying? She was talking about, Hegel is the reasonable one. This lady and her group were petitioning Hegel last year when he was being confirmed in the Senate. And they're calling him all kinds of names. And now Hegel to him is the reasonable one because he's...
She was not, Linda, Medea Benjamin was not praising Chuck Hegel or, you know, holding him up as some great example. Her point was that he was hired to wind these wars down. And you know, apparently this administration has decided that they're just not going to go down that road anymore. And
well,
I think
I'm tired of people constantly chiding, criticizing this administration, because I don't see a heck of a lot of support from either people on the radio that call themselves progressives or people. They stay behind. And then,
Linda, if the Obama administration's decision now is to ramp up the wars in the Middle East, to reengage in Iraq and Afghanistan, is that something that you support simply because Barack Obama is president?
No.
Is that something you support?
No, I don't support war.
Then why would you get angry with Medea and me for saying that maybe we shouldn't be doing this?
I get angry on one point, because people like me will go out and try to get people elected. And all we hear on radio are, well, they're all the same. They don't do this.
Well, you've never heard me say that, Linda. You might have heard Pap say that this morning. You'll never hear me say that.
And also, the guy that you bring in all the time, it's who you associate with and who you bring with. That also.
Linda, thank you very much. If you want to program a radio show, get a job as an executive producer. Don, we got to wrap it up. Don, hang on. We'll pick you up in the next hour. It's coming up on the top of the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program. The Oath Keepers are, we'll find out. We're going to find out from Sheriff Mack what they're up to. But Ferguson is starting to, Ferguson is on tender hooks right now. Tender hooks, I guess that's the phrase. You know, what shall happen? In fact, a woman bought a gun and just shot herself with it yesterday. More on that after the break.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you.
WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Ferguson is on pins and needles as the citizens of Ferguson and many people who have come from out of town are awaiting the grand jury verdict as to whether to indict or not to indict Officer Darren Wilson for murder or for manslaughter or for nothing at all. And in the midst of this, the Oath Keepers have interjected themselves. This is a confidential note that went out seeking Oath Keeper volunteers to help protect Ferguson businesses. And so I wanted to speak with somebody from the Oath Keepers about this, a member of the board of directors of the Oath Keepers movement. Oathkeepers.org, by the way, is their website. It's Sheriff Richard Mack, the former sheriff of Graham County, Arizona, and founder of the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, CSPOA.org is that website. Sheriff Mack, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks, Tom. It's always good to be with you.
Thank you. Here's what I don't understand, I think you're spot on that people are very concerned about, freaked out about this. Becca Campbell, this woman, is 26 years old, went out and bought a gun day before yesterday to protect herself against potential violence in Ferguson, and then accidentally shot herself dead yesterday afternoon. This is how weird it's getting. But why, if you're concerned about our constitutional liberties, I don't recall anywhere in the Constitution where it establishes the right to do business, although it's implicit in multiple places.
It's called the pursuit of happiness.
Okay. So you're using that broad overview of the powers of Congress that I use. It's mentioned. Actually, the pursuit of happiness is in the Declaration of Independence, which is not a legal document. But the general welfare is both in the preamble and in the Article 1, Section 8. But the right of peaceable assembly to petition, government for redress of grievances is part of the First Amendment. Why would the Oath Keepers show up to protect the businesses instead of showing up to protect the protesters?
Well, I think that does both. And there's definitely in our statement about that, we believe that the protesters have every right to be there, every right to peaceably protest. The freedom of speech is in the very first part of the entire press release that Oath Keepers put out, I think last night or this morning. So what we don't remember very well in this country is that those specific principles apply directly to government officials. It is the government who cannot violate my right to freedom of speech. My
or
right
assembly.
To protest. They have to protect that. And instead, most of the time, government is the one destroying those or attacking those or infringing on those rights. And our point is that even in emergency situations, there's no exemption or exception to those rules. And Governor Nixon is kind of taking on the role of, I get to say what the exemptions and exceptions are.
I don't disagree with your point. Okay. It's what I don't get. I mean, here's the Oath Keepers thing. You know, we have some Oath Keepers near Ferguson who are attempting to organize a security team to defend minority-owned businesses there. And then you say, here are the specific skill sets we're looking for, you know, police officers, forward-deployed assets such as scouts with binocular rangefinder and requisite equipment, communications experts, direct-action infantry,
photographers, private drone operators, and truck drivers with military experience. And I just, what I don't get is why you're right. You know, over the weekend, I watched Citizen Four, which I really recommend you see, this movie about Ed Snowden. And, you know, basically, the government is so insanely out of control that it's mind-boggling. And I'm sure that both you and I are, you know, very well monitored.
I didn't know that you felt that way, but we totally agree that government, especially at the federal level, is totally out of control.
Yeah, and we're living in a surveillance state that makes 1984 look optimistic.
Look like kindergarten.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, all that said, why would the Oath Keepers, why not make an alliance with the protesters? Why not show up and say, we are going to go to Ferguson to defend, you know, to defend the right of people to protest, rather than we're going to go to Ferguson to protect the people who own the businesses?
Well,
there's no constitutional right to own a business. There's a constitutional right to protest. And I would think that that would also go a long way.
I disagree with you that I have the right to own property, and my business is my property.
Right. But government can regulate that. It's in the Commerce Clause.
Well, that's not intrastate. It's interstate, and they don't have the authority. This is another part where the federal government is completely out of control in their exploitation of the Commerce Clause. That's been stretched to high heaven. And our government thinks that they can control businesses within the states, and they cannot. It says interstate, between states.
Yeah, and individual states can regulate business within their borders. But and we're getting into kind of a conceptual rhetorical argument.
Your question is a good one, and I honestly felt when I read the announcement from Oath Keepers, which I did not write, but I agree with its premise, that they were going to be there to protect and watch and make sure that people protesting would be allowed to do so.
There's a big movement among the protest organizers to try to keep the crazies out, to try to stop the Ferguson equivalent of the Black Bloc guys, the people who just go around trashing businesses.
Right.
They're trying to prevent that themselves. And it seems like you would want to ally yourself with them rather than, you know, stand with a gun in front of a store.
No, but we're not aligning ourselves is with the, if you look at the footage last time, where cops were pointing high-powered rifles at citizens walking down the street. And what the officers don't understand here is that the law or the Constitution does not protect them from being offended. And when I was a cop, I was trained, when I was a patrol officer, and we did civil disobedience things. We didn't have them very often, but they did happen. But we were told, look, they can say anything about your daughter, about your mother, about your wife, about you. And
right, so sticks and stones versus words, right.
Yeah, there's nothing you can do about it. You tell them, have a great day. That's all you can do. And officers getting offended and trying to show people who's boss and getting in pride fights with protesters is really contrary to police training and what we're here for. We are there to protect life, liberty, and property, and we are there. Let me reemphasize that. We are there to protect liberty. And if they don't do that, then they're not doing their jobs.
But isn't the liberty of protesting the behavior of your government, in this case a grand jury, much more important than the liberty to conduct business?
Well, you know, I think you're hung up on a technicality that you don't need to be hung up on. Quite frankly, we want to protect everybody. And again, life, liberty, and property. And that's property. Their businesses are their property. And I don't think we're focusing on that as much as it might be in the statement or what you are interpreting from the Oath Keeper statement on this. We were much more against egregious tactics of law enforcement and of Governor Nixon of the state of Missouri. And that they need to remember who we are and what we represent, and that this is a peaceful assembly by most of the people that are going there. And that the looters and others who commit crime must be addressed separate from the other peaceful protesters. That's what we're really after.
Sheriff Richard Mack.
People protecting and watching neighborhoods,
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Sheriff Richard Mack, CSPOA.org and oathkeepers.org. Thanks for dropping by today, sir.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tom. See you.
Talking with you. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Tom in Waterloo, Iowa. Hey, Tom, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
You know.
Oh, he's having a conversation with somebody else? Okay, let's go to Don with in Columbus, Ohio, watching Free Speech TV on Dish. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hi. I remember a couple of months ago you made a comment about the number of times that the Republicans filibustered and how they set a record.
Right.
And today you mentioned the post office. So my question is, why do you make a better case for the Democrats than the Democrats make for themselves?
Well, I think this is one of the big challenges that anybody in this country has who wants to be politically active, is that the way that the Constitution set up our political system. Because we have first-past-the-post, winner-take-all elections, we have a two-party system. There's no way around that. Well, there are ways around that, but there's no way around that that's going to happen probably in your lifetime or mine. And as a consequence of that, when somebody looks at their own self-interest or the kind of country that they want to have, whether it's the billionaires on the one hand or people like you and me on the other, the way that either the billionaires can take over the nation, or the way that you and I could hopefully influence government to be more compassionate and more concerned about the issues of the poor and the working class rather than the billionaires, is through those two political parties, because they're the ones who actually control the levers of power in Washington, D.C. And that's why, there are individual Democrats that I salute, Sherrod Brown, Jan Schakowsky, Keith Ellison, Raul Grijalva. There is actually a fairly long list, almost 100 of them. And, good Democrats here at the federal level and a whole bunch of them at state levels in states all across the country. But they can only go as far as their party will let them go. And their party's only going to let them go as far as the volunteers on the ground, the people who work in the parties, establish. I mean, it's the precinct committee people who write the party platforms, who pick the primary candidates. And that's why I keep saying, instead of just calling into talk radio and complaining, whether it's about complaining about my show or complaining about the Democratic Party, show up at the local Democratic Party and take the damn thing over. Does this make sense, Don?
Yeah, it does. I was active in politics. My parents were very active, and then I went to Berkeley in the 60s, and I sat on my hands politically for 40 years. And then in 2004, with the Kerry election, I got involved some in politics and the Franklin County political.
Good on you.
And so I got involved, and I was active, but in recent years, I've become discouraged because of the similarities of the parties.
Well, see, that's the parties are not similar. The parties are profoundly different. There are some areas where there are some similarities, but at the deepest levels, at the philosophical levels, the Democratic and Republican parties are fundamentally different. And we need to become the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, to quote Howard Dean. We need to bring that back. And that's, the number one job of the Koch brothers and others on the right, in all of the negative advertising that they bought, in the hundreds of millions of dollars they spent, all the money that they pump out, and their support of so-called independent third-party candidates, is to cause people like you, Don, to say, to hell with it, they're all the same. They're not the same. You need to get inside the Democratic Party. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 20 minutes past the hour. Mark in Butte, Montana. Hey, Mark, you want to talk about the Oath Keepers?
Yeah, Tom. I thought Sheriff Mack said something really important when he said that when he was a police officer, he was told when they were at these demonstrations that they were not allowed. You know, the protesters could say whatever they wanted to them, anything about their daughter or their son or their wife, and you're not allowed to react or do anything. And I would be very interested to know if he is going to tell his Oath Keepers the same thing. Because it seems like what they're doing to me is just adding guns to an already volatile situation.
I agree. And guns and white guys, by the way.
Right, exactly.
Because the Oath Keepers is almost entirely white.
Largely African-American protesters going up and down the street with these white Oath Keepers and their guns standing outside businesses, and I guarantee those protesters are going to say something.
It is potentially a very inflammatory situation, and that's why I was essentially lobbying him to take the side, you know, to go arm in arm with Al Sharpton rather than going arm in arm with the local Chamber of Commerce.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
And I, who knows if what I had to say will have any effect. You know, who knows how this is going to play out. I wanted my audience to know what was going on. And you know, that's why we had him on. But I couldn't, you know, pass up making a suggestion. But we'll see how it plays out. We'll see. I mean, there's just like in any organization, but I think these far-right organizations in particular tend to draw some people who are good people of principle and a whole lot of people who are just plain old flat out crazies and racists. And the challenge that Sheriff Mack has and some of the more rational people, I think, in Oath Keepers is to keep the crazies under control and, you know, we'll see how it plays out. I'm not a big proponent of the Oath Keepers. So Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Pam in Ocala, Florida. Hey, Pam, what's up? Pam? No, Pam. Arnold in Smyrna, Tennessee. Hey, Arnold, you're on the air. Uh-oh. Our phones just croaked again? Okay, I'm going to try a few more here. Wayne in Chicago. Wayne, can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me, Tom?
I hear you just fine. What's up, Wayne?
Okay, great. Yes, I just wanted to make a few comments about the Syria situation and the Ukraine situation.
Okay.
If you remember, maybe not, because you're so busy and you have so many calls, but last year I was the one that called you and suggested to you that Assad was not responsible for those chemical weapons being dropped on those children over there. And the reason why you didn't know at the time is because you're so busy, you didn't have time to research it. But you went back and researched it, and you realized that, in fact, was the case, that Assad did not drop those chemical weapons on those kids.
Right. In all probability, I mean, we still don't know, but in all probability, it was anti-Assad guys trying to get the United States to come in and take their side and take down Assad.
No, it's been conclusive proof, Tom. But anyway.
Okay. All right.
What I'm saying is Vladimir Putin is the one who was trying to save the United States from itself by constantly bombing other countries.
Right.
So he's the one that set up that deal for Assad to get rid of his chemical weapon.
Yep.
And we thought, well, the United States has come to its senses. They won't bomb the Syrians.
Right.
Now, 2 weeks ago, Obama flipped the script. He came out and said, well, we're going to bomb Assad and ISIS.
Right.
So ISIS was just an excuse all the time to go back in and do what they delayed for a year, which is to bomb the hell out of the Syrian population trying to get rid of Assad.
And this is my great fear, Wayne, is that President Obama is going to, we're going to look back on the Obama presidency the way we do on the Lyndon Johnson presidency, which is, you know, the Vietnam War is the first thing that people think of when they think of LBJ, even though his accomplishments with the Great Society were breathtaking. I mean, it was the most radical transformation of government since FDR. But most people don't even know about it. I mean, young people who didn't live through it don't even know about it. And President Obama has actually accomplished a lot as president, and over implacable, intractable, and I think, frankly, vicious and hateful, Republican obstruction, And I'm worried that all of that's going to get lost because he's going to go down in history as the guy who continued Bush's stupid wars and put them on steroids, just like Jack Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson continued the war in South Vietnam that Richard Nixon got us into, basically, as vice president.
Okay, let me flip over to Ukraine.
Sure.
Okay, ever since this whole situation started, Putin has been the statesman. Putin has been the rational one. When the Ukraine was bankrupt, which they still are, Putin is the one who came out and said, let's work together, the United States, Europe, the Russians, and Ukraine, to try to bring Ukraine out of bankruptcy. It was the United States that said, no, we're not working with Russia our way or the highway. Right. That's what the United States told the Ukraine. So now what the United States wants to do is make Ukraine a NATO state.
Yeah.
The Russians are not going to go for that at all, Mr. Hartman. That is, I'm going to tell you something. Monopoly, the Monopoly Board, do not pass gold, do not collect $200, go straight to jail.
Mm-hmm.
The path the Obama administration is leading us down right now, do not pass gold, do not collect $200. We're going straight to nuclear war.
Because I sure hope you're wrong.
Going to allow it. Excuse me?
I said I sure hope you're wrong. But I share your concerns. We have so screwed this thing up. When you've got people like Henry Kissinger, who I'm no fan of at all, and what's the Russian guy who presided over the dissolution of the Soviet Union? Gorbachev, yeah, Mikhail Gorbachev, agreeing and saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, you got a problem. Wayne, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be back with more right after this. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 28 minutes before the hour. And a lot going on. I think that, let me see here. Pipelines exposed. Okay, I'll get into this in the third hour of our program. This just remarkable scientific study about how you and I need to regulate our exposure to sunlight based on how light or dark the color of our skin is. This has nothing to do with race, actually, and has everything to do with health. And it's this is like evolutionary biology meets public health. And it's an amazing, amazing piece that's in Science Magazine. I'll get into it in the next hour. But right now we've got a whole bunch of callers who want to get in and weigh in on what's going on. So Greg in Wheeling, Illinois. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Love you. And I just wanted to talk about Ferguson for a minute.
Okay, go for it.
Obviously, the whole grand jury thing is a joke. The grand jury would obviously invite our ham sandwich if it didn't have mustard.
Well, we don't know what this grand jury is going to do, but historically, yeah, if a prosecutor wants a grand jury to indict somebody, they can usually get that done.
Yeah.
Or not done.
But just want to let you know what I think. I don't think that the grand jury is going to come out with a verdict until Wednesday, 5 o'clock.
The day before Thanksgiving.
Day before Thanksgiving, they're going to make the people choose between protesting and being with their families. In addition, Friday morning, Black Friday, doorbuster sales.
Right.
If the turnout is low, then the police, National Guard, can be low and spend time.
Well, and on top of that, by that point in time, by the middle of the day Wednesday, all of the reporters for all of the networks who are down in Ferguson are going to be chomping at the bit to get on a plane and go home and be with their families. And
exactly.
particularly the high-profile, well-paid reporters, you know, who have enough mojo and money to make that happen, even if they have to charter a private plane. So your argument makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I'm a I'm a poker player pretty good, and I'm pretty good at knowing what the other guy's holding.
There you go. We'll see, Greg. We'll see. Let's have this conversation again in a couple of days. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, you wanted to discuss Badia Benjamin's thoughts.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tom. I want to say that the president isn't ramping up the war in the Middle East. He's not invading Iraq. It's not Vietnam.
Did you not read the piece in the New York Times over the weekend about how he has expanded the combat role of boots on the ground in Iraq?
Yeah, advisors, 3,000 advisors. I know you have to have advisors. But
no, but we're now you know, officially not just protecting ourselves and our embassy, we're protecting the Iraqi government, and we're expanding the role that we're playing in Afghanistan as well.
Yeah, well, we're going after a bunch of murderous thugs at, you know, ISIL.
I heard that from Nixon from Jack Kennedy and from LBJ too, and look how it turned out.
But it wasn't true then. That was just a bunch of innocent villagers in Vietnam. Are you comparing?
No, they were murderous.
Vietnam, really?
Well, our argument was that Ho Chi Minh in the north was a communist, that he was doing indoctrination camps, that he had stolen the private property of all the business people in North Vietnam, that everything had gone communist, that he was godless, that he had banned religion. Those things, by the way, by and large, were all true. And therefore we had, and if we wanted to stop the march of communism from going into Cambodia, Laos, and eventually ending up in California, we had to stop him right there. I mean, I've heard the murderous thug argument before. It may be true that these are not people we like. It's not a government we like. It's not, you know, whatever. But I would submit to you, Paul, read the piece at the top of Common Dreams right now. Our intervention in Syria has strengthened ISIS, not weakened it.
Well, you know, and that argument that people who are fighting ISIL are now joining them,
yeah.
I mean, that's ridiculous. If someone's murdering people in my neighborhood and someone else comes in to bomb them, I'm going to cheer it. Okay? I mean, you know, that's...
Paul,
that's
at the beginning, Jimmy Carter wrote a brilliant novel about the Revolutionary War era. And at the beginning of the Revolutionary War in 1776, July 4th, when the Declaration of Independence was signed, just about a third of Americans were in favor of seceding from Great Britain. Two-thirds of Americans, another third of Americans were strongly opposed, and about a third of Americans didn't care one way or the other. Within, you know, a year or so, once the British started actually fighting us and occupying our territory and killing us, and, they were killing our soldiers, you know, George Washington and his merry bands and Alexander Hamilton and the soldiers that he had under his control, but they were also killing, sometimes by accident, civilians. And by that time, public opinion had swung to where 70, 80, 90% of Americans were like, yeah, kill the British. You know, the enemy of, you know, these people are not behaving well towards us. Even the people who were opposed, you know, the royalists, the people who were opposed to our separating from Great Britain, changed their mind once the war started. That's what war does to people.
Yeah, right. That's true. But, I'm talking about ISIL.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, too. I'm saying you've got people.
Can I finish the sentence, Tom?
Yeah, go for it.
She says we should negotiate with ISIL. When our negotiators showed up, they would be beheaded.
She did not say that we should negotiate with ISIL. What Badia said was that we should be negotiating with the countries in the region.
That's true.
You know, to work this thing out. This is a regional conflict. This is not an international conflict. As much as ISIL is trying to make it one, it's a regional conflict.
I agree with that. And I'm all for pulling out of the Middle East, absolutely. But then what do you do about the thousands of innocent people being murdered and tortured by ISIL?
You prosecute George W. Bush for war crimes so that we never again set up a situation where thousands of people are going to be murdered and tortured. You're not going to be able to stop it.
Absolutely right. Yeah, but unfortunately Bush did what he did. So how do we deal with it? How do we clean up that mess?
There are, sometimes Humpty Dumpty can't be put back together again.
Yeah, but
we tried the democracy route. The two things that are left to us, it seems to me, I mean, if you look at the history of the region, are one, we support some strong-arm dictator, which is basically what we've been doing in both Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, for the last 4 or 5 years, 6 years, supporting Karzai and now the new guy, I'm forgetting his name, and supporting Maliki and the new guy. And they're thugs. You know, they kill their own people. They're thugs.
Yeah.
But we were, you know, it's like, But we were doing it under color of democracy, because these democracies have to come from the bottom up, and they have to be indigenous. They can't be imposed from the top down. from external countries.
That's true. But what's wrong with doing some airstrikes to save as many innocent people as possible? What's wrong with that? It's all he's doing.
You know, it sounds like a great idea, Paul. And you know, when it first started, I was thinking, okay, yeah, this makes sense. But now that – here, hang on just a second. Here's Jack Kennedy talking about this.
I don't think that unless a greater effort is made by the government to win popular support, that the war can be won out there. In the final analysis, it's their war. They're the ones who have to win it or lose it. We can help them. We can give them equipment. We can send our men out there as advisors, but they have to win it, the people of Vietnam, against the communists.
And, you know, he was right. And you know, tragically, his vice president, when he became president, didn't follow that advice. And once we inserted ourselves into that war, we polarized South Vietnam. And right. A lot of South Vietnamese suddenly became communists, even though they didn't probably know what the word meant. But they just knew that there were people who looked and talked and had the same culture and history as them, just to their north, who we had declared war on. And there were people who didn't look and talk like them and had no cultural heritage with them, who were dropping hundreds of thousands of tons of Agent Orange on their forests and their fields and bombs on their people.
Right. But see, Obama's not doing that. He's not escalating the war like Johnson did. He's just doing airstrikes, even though the Republicans are trying to push him into escalating it. He's not taking the bait. And I don't see what's wrong with what he's doing. Everyone,
Paul, if what you were saying was right, I would agree with you. But I believe that he's gone a step beyond that. Did you read the stuff in the New York Times over the weekend about this?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I encourage you to go back and read it. I mean, there has been a significant change just in the last 3 days in this administration's policies toward Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. And it has been so consequential that they fired Chuck Hagel.
Who
was a combat vet from Vietnam. I mean, if anybody knew the lessons of Vietnam, it was Chuck Hagel. And I'm no big fan of Chuck Hagel. I mean, Chuck Hagel used to be a right-wing talk show host in Nebraska, and then he became the head of the voting machine company I think he's got a very, very checkered past. But he was in Vietnam. And if they replace him with some armchair general or somebody who has no combat experience, or somebody whose combat experience, like John McCain's, is limited to flying over and dropping bombs, which is kind of video games, you know, on steroids. Paul, I really hope you're right and I'm wrong. I really do.
Me too.
But my big concern is that this president, and that's why I'm saying this, is not a criticism of President Obama. It's a plea to this administration and to its supporters to be very, very careful here. This is absolutely playing with fire in the worst way. And history should guide us. Paul, thank you for the call. I want to see President Obama succeed. I want to see his legacy be a legacy, you know, a John Kennedy legacy rather than a Lyndon Johnson legacy. I want his legacy to be one of the good things that he accomplished, not one of, he inherited a war and the things got worse. I don't want that. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is interesting. CNN is announcing right now that the Ferguson grand jury announcement is expected today. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm generally a pacifist, but I think sometimes we paint things with a broad brush. There's a small town, Kobani. Are you familiar with it?
In Syria?
Well, it's actually on a Turkish-Iraq border.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And it's a secular, egalitarian community, atheist.
Yes.
But and they've been fighting ISIS. They're the antithesis of ISIS. And so ISIS really wants to overthrow this town. And they've been running out of ammunition. They were almost completely overthrown, but until we came in and started the bombing. So, you know, when I look at that and I see these people there, I'm torn.
Yeah, me too. Me too. There are no easy answers here.
Yeah, there are no easy answers, and
it doesn't. There's no bumper sticker solution.
Yeah, unfortunately, what we've been through in the past 10 years has really messed things up, because now we really, we're very hesitant to help.
Yeah, my concern is that as I've said, this administration might be moving toward the bumper sticker solution that LBJ did of, oh, the military can fix this. After all, we took down Hitler. And, there is no analogy there. It's not an appropriate analogy. It's a very, very messy situation that has a lot of moving pieces. It's a regional conflict. If, Saudi Arabia has the third largest military in the world, why isn't Saudi Arabia in there? They're right next door.
But, well, Saudi Arabia is funding ISIS.
Excuse me, they have the fifth largest military in the world. But see, they say that they're not. And so, why are we not saying to Saudi Arabia, you guys have more military than anybody outside of Israel in the Middle East, and you've got a larger army than Israel. Why aren't you in there, defending Kobani and stopping ISIL, And not just Saudi Arabia. Qatar is Qatar is a big recipient of our largesse. I mean, there's a whole series of them that countries in the region who easily have the ability to take down ISIL. They speak the same language. They share the same ethnic and cultural background. They're not going to be viewed as those god-awful outsiders who are crusaders and, don't share our religion and don't share our way of life and don't understand us and look down on us and all this kind of stuff. Why are these countries not doing that? I think it's frankly because what we're seeing is a microcosm of this macrocosmic war that's been going on in Islam between Shia and Sunni for 800 years. On top of the fact that we have been intervening in that region for almost a century now, since the end of World War I, particularly with Saudi Arabia and propping up these petro states and these petro dictators, and it's a mess, absolutely. 10 minutes before the hour. Let's find out what Ellen Ratner has to say about this. She always has her head is screwed on straight. She has some clear-eyed perspective here. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. 10 minutes before the hour, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and find out what's going on in the world today. This Talk Radio News Report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. You can give a goat to help a returning slave in South Sudan, and free-don.org, where Don Siegelman is going to, on December 15th, be having a hearing on his continued being a political prisoner. Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, in our first hour and a half here of the program, we had on Sheriff Mack of the Oath Keepers about Ferguson, and we had on Medea Benjamin about Chuck Hagel and whatnot, and what's going on, and it sparked quite a conversation, rather. I'm curious, in particular, what's going on in those two areas.
Well, in Ferguson, I am on the American Advisory Board of Reporters Without Borders, and what concerns us is not just that there could be all kinds of violence in Ferguson, particularly if they issue something today or even tomorrow, and rumor has it it's today, but a reporter was literally standing on the street this weekend, and they arrested him. And that's the kind of thing that I am really very concerned about, that if the racial issue is one thing, the freedom of the press issue and what's happening with that in our country concerns me greatly.
I agree. By the way, CNN is announcing right now the Ferguson grand jury has reached a decision.
Okay, so they've reached a decision. We'll hear today, and who knows what will happen tonight. Now, I want to talk about Secretary Hagel. The president was very complimentary, saying he's the first enlisted combat veteran to serve as Secretary of Defense. He talked about the military being on firmer footing, that he does not make this or any other decision lightly, that we come from different areas, party, and that Hagel came with him as a candidate to Afghanistan in 2008. Well, that's just fine and dandy, except for the fact that everybody knows that he basically asked Hagel to leave.
Yeah, he fired him.
And so, I mean, this whole complimentary thing is just icing on somebody's
cake. Well, that's the dance the politicians do. What I'm curious about is what are the policy differences between the president and his former Secretary of State, Chuck Hagel, that are driving Hagel out? I mean,
well,
I
don't know what you heard. I'm curious, but I know what we've heard. We've heard that, one, he got taken to the woodshed for that ISIL remark he made a couple weeks ago, saying that they were very, very dangerous. And the White House did not know how to respond because it wasn't a scripted response on that. And so they didn't respond, and that the president was very upset that he felt Secretary Hagel went out on a limb. And the second issue is really around, again, both Afghanistan and ISIL, which is that somehow they've been allowed to increase Taliban, et cetera, increase their areas in both Syria, Iraq, and of course Afghanistan, and that is a policy difference that the president had.
So
I don't know if that's what you heard, but that's
that's consistent with what I'm hearing, and it just concerns me that we're at an LBJ moment here.
All right. So they're looking at five different people. I don't have all five who they're looking at. I do know that one is Carl Levin, who, as you know, is retiring. He's a congressman or a senator. Actually,
from Michigan.
There's a congressman, senator from
Carl
Michigan.
Levin would be brilliant.
Carl Levin would be brilliant. I love the guy. I've known him for years. And
yeah.
I think he would be great. Then there's a woman, Michelle Fleury. I'm not pronouncing her name correctly. There's a Robert Work and Ashton Carter. Both of these have been deputy undersecretaries, et cetera. They're all being looked at. And, of course, Carl Levin would have absolutely no problem being confirmed because his Senate colleagues will obviously confirm.
And wasn't he chairman of the Senate
Armed Services.
Armed Services Committee, yeah. So he knows his stuff inside out.
Absolutely. Now, meanwhile, I was at a nameless Republican event this morning, but it was interesting. I think I was the only Democrat in this group that was at this event. Maybe there were two of us, but there weren't many. And they were talking about the president's policy, and they didn't know who I was or that I could hear what they were saying. And they basically said it was a piecemeal policy. They were talking about...
Which policy are we talking about here? The military?
All of them. All of his foreign policy.
Oh, foreign policy, okay.
And they were also talking about the fact that they would like to bring back Secretary Cohn. I thought that was very interesting.
Secretary Cohen?
Cohen. And he was Secretary of Defense, remembering Mary Janet Cohn and Langmark Cohn or something, yeah. And they were also talking about Hillary Clinton, and clearly... They feel like she's more in line with them. I think they're a little frightened of her.
Isn't it true, though, that because George W. Bush, I mean, it's the Humpty Dumpty analogy. He took this egg of the Middle East and dropped it on the sidewalk. It splatted into a million pieces. The yolk got mixed up with the white. Obama's trying to put it back together, but he's having to do that in a piecemeal fashion. It's all over the place.
Well, that, I mean, it is, and it is difficult. And you don't know, I mean, we got left a mess, honestly, at the end of 2008 or at the very beginning of 2009 when President Obama stepped in.
Yeah. Okay. So what else is up?
Okay. It's interesting. The ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, is very upset with Pastor John Hagee. Apparently, Hagee said, speaking of President Obama, that he was the most anti-Semitic president in the history of the United States, and that he had broken the relationship with Israel during the last 5 years. Well, first of all, he's been president for six, but that's beside the point. ADL supports the president on this one, said that is not true. And that's pretty much where that has been in. But interesting that they decided to take on Reverend Hagee.
Hmm.
Pastor Hagin.
Because usually he's one of these big fundraisers for Israel. Kind of
now, one other interesting thing. First of all, our friend John McCain, you want to call him our friend, you know I always say that kind of stuff, kind of in cheek. He's supporting Lindsey Graham for president.
Of course. Of course. They're BBFs.
Friends and whatever.
They're
right.
Best buddies forever. Amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program. And Dave Saldana is on the line with us. He is the producer and director of Pipe Lies Exposed, the website pipeliesexposed.org, P-I-P-E-L-I-E-S, exposed.org. And Dave, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
90 pipeline spills in 4 months?
Hardly surprising. You know, there's this notion, it's been very flippant in the last couple of weeks. You know, USA Today published an editorial that said, just get it built already, in reference to Keystone XL. What they're looking at is a lot of promises from TransCanada, the pipeline company, and a lot of pie in the sky rhetoric from pipeline supporters. But what they're not looking at is the reality on the ground once this pipeline is built, if it gets built, is it's a lifetime of risk. It's risk in perpetuity for everybody who lives in the path of the pipeline. And we've discussed this before. You and I have the risk to the Ogallala Aquifer, which supplies fresh water for millions of Americans, which supplies irrigation water for farmers and livestock water for ranchers all along that path. That is a not insignificant risk. And this flippant, just get it built attitude fails to take into account just how significant that risk is and that it will last forever.
I had a caller to the program last week who I'm guessing was probably being paid by the oil industry, although you never know. I mean, sometimes it's just people who have their own agendas. But his point, and I didn't have a good response to his point. His point was, right now, this oil is being moved. I mean, you know, it's being moved into the central Midwest. It's being refined there. That's been going on for decades. And more of this oil is ending up on freight cars. And the freight cars are even more fragile and more likely to explode and more potentially destructive. And they also screw up our transportation infrastructure than the pipeline would. What is the story with this?
Well, that's a bit misleading. First off, I mean, it's true that the oil is being carried by rail and in large numbers. But we're talking about if you open the Keystone Pipeline, they want to move 830,000 barrels per day, right? That is an enormous amount. The problem that transporting it by rail produces is you simply can't move that amount. You know, it's cost ineffective. And that's the entire point of building Keystone Pipeline. You know, a lot of supporters, when you tell them that there are only 50 full-time jobs, as many as 50 full-time jobs, once the pipeline is built, they can't believe it. But that's the whole point of building it, is that labor is always one of the highest costs in any, business endeavor. So the point of building the pipeline is cut down on labor as much as possible. And you can't do that with rail. You need at least two engineers on every train at all times. And the capacity for trains to carry oil just simply doesn't reach that 830,000 barrels per day level. You've got to you have to think of it in terms of a cycle, right? The train leaves the loading point somewhere in Alberta and goes by rail down to the Gulf Coast of Texas, and then it turns around, and then it has to go back empty. Right. So think about that. You're paying twice for the travel.
Right.
Right. So that's a big part of what makes it cost ineffective.
And so if we were simply to say no to the pipeline, good luck with the rail. And given the price of oil right now in the $70 region, they may just say, okay, that's it. We'll just leave it in the ground, or we'll figure out a way to put a pipeline across Canada.
Right. We've seen that actually in the past several months. We've seen three major oil companies or oil speculators pull out of the tar sands, saying it's just not cost effective right now. And as a result of that, we're seeing TransCanada try to create a cross-Canada pipeline with Energy East. And as a result of that, we're seeing Canadians who otherwise didn't much think about the pipeline and were wondering why the U.S. was dragging its feet, are suddenly saying, wait a minute, now you're coming through my land. Let's think twice before we do this.
Right. And a large part of that is they were going to take an existing natural gas pipeline, correct me if I'm wrong, that went from Alberta all the way, or not in large part all the way to Newfoundland, and start pumping oil through that?
New Brunswick, actually.
New Brunswick, thank you.
Yeah, but it would go through Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, Quebec, and then New Brunswick. And a lot of the land that it would go through is very, very important, pristine nature land and provincial parks. It would cross the Hudson Bay or the tributaries to the Hudson Bay, so that any spill in its path would likely foul an enormous part of the natural habitat that Canadians very rightfully consider to be their birthright and something that they owe to their children and grandchildren.
I've had callers to the program from Canada describe Stephen Harper, their current prime minister, correct me if I'm wrong, as Canada's George W. Bush. How's he dealing? How's the government dealing with the possibility of blowback from their own people?
Well, I've called Prime Minister Harper Big Oil's man in Ottawa.
Right.
He came from Alberta. He came from a very conservative movement that did to the Canadian Conservative Party what the Tea Party has done to the Republicans, that is, drag them far further to the right. What they have done, and Center for Media and Democracy, for which I am a senior fellow, pointed out last week that there has been a leak of their PR plan, which is very similar to what they've done in the U.S., and that is smear their opposition, target them, dig up dirt, and buy as much good press and support as they can.
Right.
So what we're looking at is a dishonest campaign that refuses to acknowledge the facts on the ground and debate the real issues.
We're talking with Dave Saldana, producer, director of the new movie Pipe Lies Exposed, the documentary pipeliesexposed.org. Tell us about the documentary, Dave.
Well, the documentary was produced in late 2013 through early this year. And what we looked at was a lot of the rhetoric that came from TransCanada and their supporters in the American Petroleum Institute and in Congress. And the claims that they were making about jobs and tax money and infrastructure and all of the benefits that would accrue to the U.S. if we just built this pipeline. And what we did is looked at those facts and compared them to what we already know. And that is,
we already have plenty of pipelines in the United States.
Right.
Including
right.
many of them carrying this exact same oil.
Right. And what we've what we learned is that their promise of 42,000 jobs, as many as 120,000 jobs coming from this pipeline, were grossly exaggerated. The researchers at Cornell University looked at their claims and found them to be without substantial proof, which basically means they pulled it out of thin air. What we found when we looked at the State Department report, and mind you, the State Department report was written by it was contracted out to a company that has business transactions, ongoing business transactions with TransCanada, which clearly should have been a violation of ethics. But what we got is a claim that, hey, these jobs, maybe 4,000 over the course of 2 years during construction, maybe 50 once it's built.
No big benefit to us. Dave Saldana, you can check out the movie over at pipeliesexposed.org. Dave, good work. Great work. Thank you for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Pipe Lies, L-I-E-S, exposed.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom in Waterloo, Iowa, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I have a quick question or slash comment in reference to this whole thing in Ferguson. Has it ever been brought to light that PTSD and law enforcement may have taken a huge role in the issue? A while ago, we attended a workshop with a soon-to-be-retired Waterloo police officer, and I brought to her the question of PTSD, and she said, well, that's a good question, because even though the police unions acknowledge PTSD as being a serious problem, the administrative branch of law enforcement did not, and they're sending these guys out on the streets in the virtual basket cases, and, you know, I mean, in a case with the all-white police, I mean, with a predominantly white police force in a black neighborhood, I'm sure these guys catch a lot of flack, but, I mean, that's just a recipe for disaster. I mean, and oddly enough, right after this this seminar that I had, lo and behold, heck, we had a shooting of an unarmed gentleman under the same circumstance in a very bad neighborhood. I mean, it's just, this PTSD in law enforcement is something that's just not brought out into the public very much, and it doesn't seem like the administration is really willing to do a whole heck of a lot about it. And even when you, with all these veterans coming back from the Gulf, I mean, a lot of them have PTSD, and they're being put right into law enforcement. Yeah. So, I mean, we've got a real problem with that.
Well, and you have to ask yourself the question, why is it that we have this problem here in the United States and they don't have a similar problem in Denmark, for example, where actually they have a growing population of immigrants of color who are on the receiving end of an awful lot of hate from the Danish equivalent of the KKK, and it's become very politically contentious. Same thing in Sweden, not so much in Norway, but you know, many of the Scandinavian countries. And the reason why their police are not killing people of color or poor people the way that our police are, and we saw there was one report this morning that one of these police departments now, I think it's the new FBI report, that more people are killed by police than kill police. In fact, in some parts of the country, being killed by a police officer is one of the leading causes of death. And the reason, when you look at the difference between our police forces and the police forces in Northern Europe, there they pay their police officers the equivalent of what in the United States would probably be between $75,000 and $125,000 a year. Plus, they have, you know, full benefits, pensions, health insurance, everything. And in exchange for that, they require a level of education and, you know, the ability to pass both psychological and emotional testing. That's you know, a very high bar. It's a profession there. It's a profession that people are very proud of, as opposed to simply being a job and a job that's sort of, you know, a bottom of the barrel job in many regards in many places in this country, which is really tragic. I think we need to raise the pay and raise the standards in the United States. Makes sense?
Yes, I agree very much, and that's exactly what this lady said. And she also stated that women police officers were also treated very poorly by administration.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, it's like you're getting beat on both ends.
Yeah.
You know, it's like.
Oh yeah, the cops are getting it from every direction. I mean, you've got to have a lot of empathy for them. On the other hand, they're running around with guns, killing people, and that's not good either. There is a solution, and the Republicans get hysterical when you say it, but the solution is money. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Past the hour, it's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and John in Paris, Idaho. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I really appreciate your program and the investigative reporting you do. I work on environmental issues here, and since the Keystone Pipeline's been such a high priority item lately, I wanted to point out a couple of things. I'm, of course, opposed to that, but I Googled recently, Alberta map tar sands,
mm-hmm.
And if you do that, you see that about a third of Alberta is underlain by these tar sands. And so my question would be there, are we going to actually allow them to strip mine a third of the province of Alberta for this oil, which is nasty stuff? And the second point I wanted to bring up was I was just reading an old article in the New York Times about agricultural pollution of the Ogallala Aquifer from pesticides and nitrates, and pointing out how no one's really taking that on because of the role of corn in the economy.
Right.
And so while I sympathize with farmers and ranchers, we need to be looking at the Ogallala in its entirety, not only the risk from Keystone, but the agricultural pollution that's already occurring there from pesticides, nitrates and fertilizers, those sorts of things.
Agreed. In answer to your first question, I think the answer is yes. Those parts of Alberta tend to be fairly sparsely populated. It's mostly Indian land or was Native American land. First Peoples land, I believe, is the phrase of the appropriate phrase in Canada. And it's the First People. It's the Natives, the Native Americans, Native Canadian North Americans, who are in many cases the strongest opponents to this, ripping up of Mother Earth and pulling out this carbon monster. So, anyhow, John, your point is well taken, and although it's a somewhat different topic, but it's certainly one that needs to be paid attention to. Thanks for the call, Richard, driving through Utah. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind?
Hey, great day to you, Tom.
Thank you.
I was listening to the interview you were doing with the gentleman from the Oath Keepers.
Yeah, Sheriff Matt.
And I could not help but, picture in my mind an armed militia walking in there, with their own agenda.
Yeah.
Because that's all this thing sounds like. They're looking for people with guns. They're looking for people with paramilitary-type experience. Who invited these guys to come and put and designate themselves as peacekeepers?
Right. They're inviting themselves. And this is, I think that they are pouring gasoline on a fire. And I think that they're doing it in a very dangerous way. And it's one of the reasons why I kept coming back to the point of essentially saying, why don't you align yourself with the protesters rather than aligning yourself with the property, with the business owners? And we'll see how it plays out. My guess is that they're not going to be a consequential force there, that this was more a PR stunt on their part. But who knows? Time will tell. CNN is reporting that the grand jury has reached a verdict, but they have 48 hours before they have to release that verdict. We had a caller earlier who said, I predict that when the verdict is released, it will be Wednesday evening or Wednesday afternoon. And because he was like, then the protesters are going to have to choose, do we want to get ready for Thanksgiving or do we want to go out and protest? And I added to that, if it's released on Wednesday afternoon, then the news reporters are going to have to say, do I want to stay here or do I want to go home and be with my family? And I think that it might, although it may sound kind of sneaky and manipulative to release the report on Wednesday afternoon, it actually may be the best thing for everybody involved. you know, give people a day or two to just kind of amp it down. But we'll see. We'll see. I don't have any control over these events. I just report, you know, we report, you decide, right? Ronnie in Jefferson, Wisconsin. Hey, Ronnie, what's up?
Hi, I was listening to the Seldane report on pipelines.
Yeah.
And I called in last week, and I just want to say again, we are living in a tar sand sacrifice zone here. All this attention has been going to the Keystone and to the Canadian Enbridge lines. Enbridge has a line in Wisconsin that is at least a quarter bigger than Keystone, and it is operational. We're just trying to keep them from expanding it. I'm hoping that the media will pay a little bit of attention to the Enbridge Southern Access Line 61 corridor,
mm-hmm.
that if they can biff this up, we'll be pumping a total of 2,190,000 barrels per day to the three lines that they've got in there. So
yeah, I remember your call, Ronnie. Good point, and thanks for keeping our collective eyes on that one, too. Thank you. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Okay, I called in about ISIS, but also listening to this talk about the tar sands reminded me of a conversation I had with the guy that repairs the tank cars for the railroad. Mm-hmm. Apparently that stuff is really corrosive. It heats the welds out where the cars are put together. That's why they've had so many accidents and explosions and spills.
Right.
And imagine this stuff attacking the welds in a section of pipeline way away from wherever anybody's looking at it,
Oh, yeah, and there have been places where 70% of the welds fail when they're pressure tested.
Yeah.
I mean, this pipeline has not always been built by the best and the brightest or whatever. You know, it's always lowest bidder. Who's going to do it fastest? You know, not a good thing.
But about our intervention in the Middle East, I mean, why does our government keep insisting on sticking its nose into family fights?
Abraham Maslow, back in the 70s, the founder of one of the major schools of psychology, said that when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. We have, roughly half of our government is invested in our military. It's our biggest expense. It's our biggest expenditure. It's our biggest hammer. And it's a very, very seductive hammer for people who become president. To use. If history is any indication. Chris, thanks for the call. I think that that's what's going on. And I hope I'm wrong. I really, really, really hope I'm wrong. Because I want this president to succeed, and I want him to have a legacy that for a century or more, people look back on and say, that guy was consequential.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And we'd be saying that about LBJ right now if it wasn't for the Vietnam War, because what he did with the Great Society was amazing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain. The Tom Hartman Program does not lead to stiff thinking, though. Let me just share with you, and then I'm going to back to your phone calls. I see the lines are all lit up here, but I just wanted to. I read this story last week. It was on November 21st, and last Friday, in the current issue of Science Magazine, which is published by the American Academy for the Advancement of Sciences, the AAAS, which I'm a member of, and I've been giving memberships to my kids for years for Christmas. It's just an amazing publication. And in the 21st November issue, volume 346, issue 6212, there's an article titled Shedding Light on Skin Color. And it talks about the research of this extraordinary woman by the name of Nina Jablonski. She starts out, she says, she is, by the way, a biological anthropologist. So the question that she's asking is, why is it that some of us have light skin and some of us have dark skin and some of us have colors in the middle, and what does that have to do with anything? Why did evolution make that happen? Clearly, 60,000 years ago and old and longer back than that, when we were all basically in Africa, we all had very dark skin. As people migrated out of Africa, their skin lightened in some areas. But then as they moved into places like the Himalayas, where they're higher up and closer to the sun and therefore getting higher levels of ultraviolet light, their skin darkened again. As they moved in from back down into the southern parts of India, their skin darkened again as the UV light came up, even though their other characteristics, their other facial characteristics, resemble those of the people from northern India who have lighter skin. They look more, more like they're more European than African. People from who had made it all the way to Asia 40,000 years ago and were living in northern Asia in temperate areas, their skin had lightened up considerably. They traveled to the Americas, and some ended up in places like Andes Mountains, where their skin darkened again. Because, again, they were at high altitudes, they were exposed to strong levels of ultraviolet light. Or Central America, their skin darkened. So light skin, dark skin is not an issue of race. There are people who look Caucasian who have dark skin, you know, in terms of the traditional classic kind of features that define things like, you know, mouth shape and eye shape and nose shape, or look Asian, or look, fill in the blanks, who have light skin or dark skin. Why? Now, the traditional explanation for why that most people, you know, sort of learned in high school biology is to prevent skin cancer. Right? The whole idea that because melanin, which is the pigment that's in our skin, that darkens our skin, and that for light-skinned people, when they're exposed to sunlight, they get a tan, melanin increases, and dark-skinned people are born with high levels of melanin in their skin. Melanin blocks ultraviolet light. And ultraviolet light is what causes skin cancer. But here's the problem. I mean, everybody just kind of always assumed that this is what it's all about. But as Nina Jablonski points out, that doesn't explain evolution. Because skin cancers typically develop when people are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and evolution doesn't give a rat's ass what happens to you when you're 60 or 70 years old. Evolution is all about producing offspring. Evolution is about the first 20 years of human life, about the ability to be fertile and produce children. It's Richard Dawkins wrote a book about this called The Selfish Gene. So the question she was asking is, I'll read from the Science article. In the tropics, she says, light-skinned people that's getting right to the answer. So first of all, it has nothing to do with skin cancer. That's a side effect. People with dark skin who are exposed to a lot of sun are less likely to get skin cancer. People who have light skin are exposed to a lot of sun, more likely to get skin cancer. But that's not why light and dark pigments in skin evolved. What she points out is that under the skin, you've got the skin, first of all, is the largest organ in the body. And under the skin, there are miles of little tiny capillaries, the size of a thread and smaller in some cases, that carry, you know, gallons and gallons of blood every hour in circulation. I mean, you know, we've got, 8 pints of blood in our body. But, you know, they're constantly moving blood right underneath the skin. Now, two things happen when the blood inside those capillaries is exposed to UV radiation from sunlight. The first is that it produces vitamin D. Vitamin D is necessary for strong bones. It prevents rickets. And, in fact, it's a principal modulator of our immune systems. So getting an appropriate amount of ultraviolet light to produce vitamin D, and, in fact, there was one study that she did that was just absolutely amazing. She went into South Africa. This was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And they looked, it was an 8-year study of 370 township dwellers in the Cape Flats township of Cape Town, South Africa. This is basically a slum with 600,000 people in it. And the people vary in skin color from fairly light to fairly dark. And what she found was that the darker your skin was in this place in South Africa, which is way down in the southern end of Africa where you don't have really intense sunlight, And a lot of the people with very dark skin there were over the were immigrants over like a 10,000 year period. That the people with darker skin had lower levels of vitamin D. What did this mean? It meant that every year from October to December, there was an epidemic of tuberculosis in this slum, in this area. But it didn't happen. This is when there's less sunlight. It doesn't happen when there's more sunlight, because vitamin D modulates the immune system and helps the body fight off the bacteria, the bacillus that causes TB. But that, again, isn't enough to confer a reproductive advantage. How do we get to a reproductive advantage? A member of my family, one of my cousins, had a child with spina bifida. This is a horrible, horrible thing, a neural tube disease, where the spine, basically, the baby's born with the spine open and the spinal column exposed, and it produces a fundamental mental retardation. Her daughter never spoke anything that didn't sound like a little baby. She died when she was in her late teens or early 20s and never got out of a diaper. This is caused, we now know, and we didn't know this 20 years ago when my cousin had this child, but what we know now is that this is caused by folate deficiency. Folate is folic acid. It's the stuff that's in green things. So if you eat greens, you get folic acid. It's one of the reasons why pregnant women are put on folic acid vitamins, although the best way to get it is to eat a lot of green stuff. It's because there's all these other coenzymes and co-things that go along with it. But it turns out that when blood containing folate in the capillaries, in the skin, is exposed to UV radiation, it breaks down the folate. So the more intense the sunlight and the lighter the skin, the more likely a person is to have children with terrible birth defects and other diseases that are associated with folic acid deficiencies. But mostly it's about children. On the other hand, with people who have darker skin but are not getting enough sunlight, so the first is people who have lighter skin and are getting too much sunlight. And by lighter skin, I'm not necessarily talking about white people. This study was done with a population that was entirely considered either, using the old language of South Africa, either colored or black. And colored being kind of essentially biracial or light-skinned Africans. So with dark-skinned folks who don't get enough sunlight, because it takes a lot of sunlight to penetrate through all that melanin, they don't have a problem with the folate, the folic acid breaking down, but they do have a problem with not having enough vitamin D. Not enough vitamin D, your baby's bones don't form properly. In fact, your baby may just miscarry. So it turns out, and she's got this study, you know, Bolivian Highlanders, dark skin from intense UV in the Andes, Native North Americans. There's a gradient in skin tone that has to do with UV intensity. Scandinavians, very pale skin, very, very rapidly absorb vitamin D in exposure to sunlight. But on the other hand, if they get too much sunlight, it breaks down folate, and they give birth to deformed children. Tibetans, even in the Chopi of Mozambique. So the net of this, what the public health consequences of this are, that the darker your skin is, the more sunlight you actually need to get vitamin D. The lighter your skin is, particularly if you're female of childbearing ages of years, the less sunlight you want to get. Now, you want to get a certain amount to get vitamin D, but if you go beyond that threshold, you start breaking down folic acid and setting up a consequence for birth defects. So by the last 1,000 years or so of us moving people all around the planet, taking people from Africa, bringing them to North America, for example, Europeans going into equatorial areas, you know, light-skinned people in dark-skinned areas, is we've created a public health disaster for ourselves.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And it all has to do with evolution. It's just an amazing, amazing thing. So I had to share that with you. I hope you don't mind my going off on science for a few minutes. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And now let's get back to politics. Karen in Whittier, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Karen, what's up?
Hey. If anybody watched the Frontline special on ISIS, it was very enlightening.
I did not see it. Tell me what your takeaway was.
My favorite part of it, because it really explained the evolution of ISIS very, very well. But my favorite part of it is when they went into Kurdistan. You know, you see, they showed most of Iraq, and it was just devastated. You go into Kurdistan, and wow, it's in really good shape because all the oil companies are there.
Well, also, and we had never bombed Kurdistan. I mean, we bombed the bejesus out of much of Iraq, and I mean, you know, we took down a third of the city of Fallujah. We blew up a big chunk of Baghdad, but we never bombed Kurdistan because it wasn't a quote conflict area. They were not loyal to Saddam to begin with. They'd been trying to separate from Saddam.
But and because the oil fields are all over there.
Oh yeah, there's that too. Yes, of course.
The oil fields are there.
So what you're saying is it's all about the oil?
Oh, really? I wouldn't have known that. Yeah. The thing is that the ISIS has been funding themselves with oil. And you know, from Libya, from you know, until you know, because that was the whole deal. Remember Libya? He was, you know, Gaddafi was public enemy number one until he said, okay, fine, you can have the oil fields. And then all of a sudden, oh, all is forgiven.
Right.
You know, we even gave him back his bomber. And,
right.
You know, that's like the major problem is the easiest way to take out ISIS at the beginning was to go after the Syrian oil fields and bomb them.
In other words, if we had bombed the oil fields, then ISIS would look at them the same way that we would if they were growing asparagus and say, we don't care.
Selling oil to Turkey, selling oil all over, you know, the area.
Right.
And that would have been a simple solution. Of course, we're not going to do that. You go into Kurdistan and, like I said, it's, you know, that's a lot of the problems, too, is that people in the region are angry because we're constantly there stealing their resources. And they're left with nothing. You know, these are poor people. They're poorly educated now because, you know, they've gone almost a whole generation of nothing, you know, no education, nothing. And you've got a 43% unemployment amongst young males. You know, this is a powder keg, you know, so of course they're going to just be angry. And then, yeah, you know, the oil prices are dropping here, and I hope everybody realizes this is an artificial.
Listen, drop. Karen, listen to this. This is from George W. Bush's announcement to the people of Iraq that he was going to begin bombing Iraq at the very beginning of the war. Here's what he said.
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells, a source of wealth that belongs to the Iraqi people.
There you go. That was George W. Bush telling the people of Iraq, we're going to bomb your country, but don't you blow up your own oil fields. We want them. And I think basically he was saying the same thing to the U.S. military. We're not going to destroy the oil fields, right? I mean, that's the point you're making, Karen?
They protected them.
Yeah, they protected them. Amazing. I'm going to have to check that out. Karen, thank you for the heads up. 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just apropos of a conversation I just had with Karen on the telephone. The oil fields of Kurdistan are still intact. Many of the oil fields of Iraq are still intact. When George W. Bush went on television and said, I want to talk to the Iraqi people. We're going to begin bombing your country. We're only going to take out your president and your government. You know, don't worry, we're not going to hurt you. He had this to say. Listen to this.
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells, a source of wealth that belongs to the Iraqi people.
So that was George W. Bush, literally at the moment the bombs were starting to fall in Baghdad in 2003. A year before that, here's Dick Cheney referencing the consequential importance of Iraq.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Second largest source of oil on Earth. You think this might have something to do with what's going on in the Middle East? Tom and Beatrice, Nebraska. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to make a comment, an item from the first hour when you mentioned there were 72 legislative days in 2009 when he could have passed anything he wanted.
Yeah.
It's a favorite right-wing talking point. You hear it all the time on Meet the Press or C-SPAN. I want to point out that it was much less than 72 days because of illness. Kennedy was gone for weeks at a time for treatment for his glioma that eventually killed him in December. Robert Byrd from West Virginia was gone for weeks at a time because of his advanced age. He died at 92, at the age of 92 in June of 2010. And Senator Tim Johnson, Democrat from South Dakota, had a stroke in February and was on a leave of absence until September. He was gone that much past, 2 months past the time when Franken was seated. I wanted to make sure those points were made, if you don't mind.
That's brilliant, Tom. I had completely forgotten about all three of those things. Do you know how many legislative days Obama had then in consequence of that?
No, I don't. I didn't count them.
Yeah. And that would be, you know, for any of our, you know, bean counter types who are listening, that would be a good number to look up. That would be fascinating. So I can recalibrate my 72-day rant.
If they can find out just exactly what week Kennedy and Byrd were unavailable, because that wasn't information that was widely publicized.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. But those were days when they would not have been able to overcome a filibuster. So basically they were just, you know, marking time. Tom, thank you for the call. Scott in Missoula, Montana. Hey, Scott, what's up?
I was calling about some of the damage with the pipeline in North Dakota, the different pipelines. Okay. Also, I found out there were like 1,000 settling ponds left from the small oil boom they had in the 80s, and they still haven't been cleaned up. And now there are thousands of more ponds left, and basically, I think it's going to get stuck with the taxpayers after the little boom is over in about 20 years.
Wow.
You know.
So North Dakota is basically becoming Love Canal.
Right, and. And they first they said, well, let's fix it out of our fund. No, they have just a fraction of what those 1,000 ponds even cost
right in
the fund.
Well, what's this thing about lightning strikes?
Okay, their biggest spill in North Dakota was caused by a lightning strike. It blew a hole in one of the pipelines, and it leaked for at least 12 days, they figured. And a farmer discovered it while cutting his wheat. He noticed his tractor's become all shiny. And that was the outskirts of the spill, and it had gotten quite a ways away by then. But they have a rule there that they can't let the public know about these kind of disasters for 6 months to protect the business in North Dakota.
Oh, is that bizarre. Now, why was the pipeline not protected by lightning rods? Ben Franklin invented the damn things. It's not like they're some newfangled.
You wouldn't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. Run a wire the length of the pipeline, run grounds about every section, and put lightning rods on it.
Right. But apparently that's like beyond the competence of the engineers of the Keystone or the pipeline companies. Amazing.
Right, and that's something maybe that people need to be aware of that could happen with Keystone, especially if they don't do something like that.
Right. Incredible. Scott, thank you for the call. Joe in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom? Great show.
Good,
man.
Thank you.
Hey, I just wanted to say, today, I live south of the Marcellus Shale, where there are digging holes everywhere.
In Pennsylvania?
Yeah. And today on the news, when I was watching it, there's a city north of where I'm at, about 50 miles, and it's called Dixon City. And in a shopping area, they had a 16-inch line relief valve. Actually, fortunately, it worked. It vented out, and the gas was, like, just screaming out for, like, around 40 minutes. And fortunately, there was a windy day today because it helped a lot dissipate the gas.
Right. So there was less risk of explosion. I mean, this is methane.
It's like, Yeah, and unfortunately, they have no idea why it happened. You know what I mean? And like you were even saying about, you know, that where the man was just speaking to you about the lightning strike, you know. But probably because they had to use a copper wire, you know what I mean? That's expensive.
Right. You're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, but, it's very unfortunate, you know what I mean, if something bad does happen. Because, you know, not many years ago, you know, what happened down in New Jersey was super disastrous.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's the Kalamazoo River in Michigan, too.
Yeah, and it just gets frightening every day. You know, people can't drink the water, you know, and people not being truthful what's going on with the pipelines, you know, if there is a spill. And it's all ends up disastrous for the people that are, you know, just people, you know, doing their daily lives and just trying to make a living.
Yeah, this is why PipeLiesExposed.org is so worth checking out. Joe, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for being with us. It is it's Thanksgiving week. It's going to be a very, very interesting week, though. I have a feeling we're going to see a lot of stuff dropped just when they don't want us to be paying attention. So pay attention. Right? Democracy doesn't – it's not just enough to vote. It really and truly does begin with you. Tag your – we'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.